Hey guys, welcome to the Boning Soul Podcast. Thanks for joining me again. Okay, so today, not much of an intro, honestly. Not really a ton of intro to be had. I've just been working, lots of work. Been trying to get out a little bit to do some of these cold shot challenges and stuff, you know, from the Broken Arrow Podcast. That's been fun, but I'm like working 6 days a week, so it's just a lot of time. Just not really any time to get out in the woods and do much of anything at all. Like I said, turkey season, it's going to be no fun intended. It's going to be kind of like a flop for me. Main reason being that, like I said, I'm just not being able to get out. I think I've only gotten out once for about 2 hours, and that's about it. So it's like, I don't know, I'm recording this intro on May 8th, so I've got like the rest of May basically, but you know, we're like about 3 weeks into this, and I've literally set foot in the woods once, and it's kind of sad. But anyway, just trying to shoot a lot, just, you know, doing the normal stuff, and trying to get better, right? Like always, trying to get better on my form, on my release, all that kind of good stuff. So other than that, really, it's going to be a very short intro, so we can get some of these other kind of commercials, if you will, out of the way, you know. So obviously this podcast partially brought to you by the Push Archery Center of Knowledge, all those awesome courses that are on there. I've talked about them a lot. Very cool stuff out there. You guys have, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you know what those are. Highly recommended. Go check those out. And also, let's see what else we got. Okay, so Hiko Ito Knives, right? Hiko is in Hawaii. We're trying to get him on the podcast, but it sounds like he lives like really, really remote. So Hiko, if you're listening to this, we're gonna have to hook up and get you on, because I really want to talk to you. But sounds like, man, you're even more remote than remote. So we'll see what we can do with that one. If you're looking for some awesome knives, definitely, you know, check them out, hikoito.com. Go check them out on Instagram. And there is a discount code also for the EDC Skinner Light. I'll probably leave it, if I remember to do it, I'll leave it in the show notes over here on this podcast. And yeah, that's kind of going to be it. So go check out those cool things. Go check out Instagram. Starting to put out some more videos again, just, you know, shooting and, you know, thoughts and ramblings, random ramblings and shootings and then that kind of stuff. So it's been fun. So I'm going to try and keep that up, obviously, through the summer and, you know, just keep in shooting shape, basically. So with that said, I have today Ethan Page, right? He has a YouTube channel called Backwards Hat Traditional. And we started talking. It was kind of like, hey man, do you want to do a podcast with me? And he's like, yeah, sure, whenever. And it actually worked out great, because it happened to be one of those ones where, you know, he couldn't do it till late because, you know, like family life and all that. And I said, perfect, that works fine for me, because I'm in the same situation. And he's Central Time, I'm Central Time, so we started a podcast, and then lo and behold, it was like, you know, 11 something at night, and I had to get up for work in the morning. So a bit of a longer one, but it was fun. It was great talking to him, picking his brain. Real, real woodsman. Real kind of, sticks to like traditional like values as far as like how he hunts, how he shoots, the importance of, you know, heritage and that kind of stuff. We'll get into all that kind of stuff. We'll get into everything with it. So I'm glad he was on. So, you know, Ethan, thank you for doing the podcast. I greatly appreciate it. So if you want to check his stuff out, go check him out. Yeah, like I said, Backwards Hat Traditional on YouTube. I believe he's under Ethan_Page on Instagram. It might pop up as Backwards Hat as well. I'm not really sure. Sorry, I couldn't quite remember. But anyway, go check him out. Good stuff he's putting out there. The more content, the better for everybody. And by the way, if anybody, you guys are listening and you're like thinking about like starting a channel or starting a podcast, right? Just go do it, right? I mean, we want to consume as much as we can, even if you don't think that you're going to put out like high quality stuff, it really doesn't matter. I don't put out high quality stuff. I just like doing what I do, and it's fun, and you know, I get to share it with people. And if you think that, you know, oh man, I can't really do this on my phone, I don't really have a video camera, I do everything on my phone, right? So go out, put out content, do stuff, and just, you know, get in the community, because the more the better. I don't know. That's just my little kumbaya kind of rambling there. But anyway, that's it. It's a short intro. 5 minutes is short for me. So here is my interview with Ethan Page.
Hey.
Yep, it should be on the same.
Says starting. There we go. Perfect. All right. You good to go?
Yep, good to go.
Awesome, man. So we have Ethan Page, right? That's an easy name to not screw up. I screw up people's names all the time. And we decided to do this like super last minute. I'm like, hey, you want to jump on a podcast? And you're like, yeah, let's do it. And it worked out because you're like, hey, I can't do it before 8 or 9 at night. Got to get the kids down. I'm like, perfect. You know, same situation with me. So here we are. We're recording at like 9 something at night. I appreciate you being on.
No problem. Thanks for having me. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. So literally after we connected on Skype, by the way, it's kind of funny. So for my job, I'm still like technically like on call, like right Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights, right? For where I work. And then you and I connected. You're like, hey, okay, you know, because it's the, you know, you got to send out the Skype invite and whatnot. And then literally like, all right, I'm good to go. I get a call from work, right? And they're like, yeah, we have a whole, we make, where I work, we make like, got in these giant, like, you know, 6, 10,000, whatever gallon, stainless steel tanks, right? We make like laundry and like lotion.
Oh, sure.
And, yeah. Yeah. That kind of stuff. Right. Yeah. So they call up and they're like, oh yeah, we've got a, like a quarter size hole in the bottom of one of these tanks. And it's just like pouring out all this product. And I'm like, oh, geez.
Nice.
You know, so, but wait, there's another supervisor there, you know, so he calls me and I'm like, hey, do this, 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 and this. And then there's nothing else, I can do for it till I get there in the morning, you know? So yeah, it was like, kind of like last minute. I'm like, oh shit, am I going to have to go into work? But no, we're good. So.
Perfect. I'd say you're probably relieved as well, I would imagine.
I am. And I called him back and I said, hey, I'm going to be like incommunicado for the next like hour, hour and a half. So something handles, you know, whatever, just do this and then just handle it. I want to do a podcast.
Here you go. Here you go. This is the baby. Take it.
Figure it out. Yeah. You can't ruin it any more than it's ruined already. So
nope.
It's good to go. So, anyway, you have the YouTube channel, Backward Tat Traditional, right?
Yep.
And that's where I first started following you. And which is, I don't know, like relatively recently, like in the last few months, I think, because you've been putting out like a lot of content. And just like anybody else that I see, I'm like, okay, cool. Here's someone that I kind of want to get to know. And I just reached out to you, said, hey, you know, want to just pop on and kind of BS for a while. So here we are.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's a labor of love so far. Like I started the channel and I kind of had a YouTube channel a little bit because it kind of started as like a carpentry thing, actually, because I've been a professional carpenter for several years and kind of sharing some insights and stuff there. And really kind of, you know, saw some of the holes in everything and the information that's out there. And as almost kind of selfish as it sounds, the way that I learned, there was not a lot of people putting out information the way that I learn, and I feel like a lot of people kind of relate with the way I learn. So I took that as an opportunity to, like, you know what, I'm going to put out the content that I would, you know, I would like to see. So it's been cranking full time probably since last April. So we're about a year in.
That's, you know, that's 100% kind of the way I approached, my channel too. I said, you know, look, I'm not an expert in whatever stage I'm at. Right. I mean, obviously I know more now than I did like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever. But, I kind of went at it the same way, thinking I learn a certain way and I just want to like teach what I know, whatever it is that I know, whatever level that I'm at, so that someone below me or behind the curve, let's say, can maybe absorb it the way I do, you know. And if that's one person, that's great. If that's 100 people, that's great, you know. So I do like your push. I don't think I ever watched your carpentry stuff though. So is that what you are you like a professional carpenter for your occupation now? Or
I was up until I would say 2021 is whenever I made the jump. I'd done commercial and residential. I kind of started, I got my feet wet in commercial and did, you know, commercial buildings and bridges. Was on a lot of bridges and built a lot of bridges, like county stuff and state stuff. And then my passion is just, it was always kind of in residential, just houses and stick framing and stuff like that, that just always kind of had an allure to me. And like, you know, like if you're a carpenter, then you need to go jump head first into residential. So I did that for a couple years, made lead carpenter for a couple different contractors, both by the time I was in my early 20s. And then after that, kind of got to a place where head and heart needed mental, you know, needed a change, needed a change of direction. And actually moved over to, I've been working as a roof truss designer for going on 2 years this August. It's one of those things, it's kind of a culture shock. You know, I still have days where I sit traumatized in my office, like, man, it'd be a beautiful day to be out, you know, framing some walls and flipping walls or setting trusses or something like that. And I'm stuck in this darn office, but, it's a great company. And truthfully, I get to still do business with all my friends, from the, you know, Rip Snorton days in the field and all that. So it was a good change, but it taught me a lot about my work ethic, and kind of gave me a big direction as a person, and how to be a leader. So it was a good life path, and I do miss it sometimes. I do some side work. I actually just did a nice little side job here that I wrapped up here the other day, and just to kind of still keep the skills up and keep my feet wet. But
so, that's, I like hearing that, because I mean, it sounds like you kind of, you know, you moved on from what you were doing. You made, like, I don't know if it's like a lateral move or, you know, vertical move, whatever, but then you're like, look, I'm just going to crush it, you know, whatever I'm doing here. So, you know, in your new role kind of thing, did you always have like natural ability with, you know, like woodworking and things like that? Cause I don't possess that gene at all.
I mean, to be totally honest, I mean, I most of my experience before going into the field was, like, there's pictures of me when I was probably 5-6 years old, helping my dad build the steps into the basement house that I grew up in, or building sheds on the farm. And, and to be totally honest, it was kind of a happy accident that me and carpentry found each other, if you will, because as I stated when we were talking off air, I spent 6 years in the National Guard, Army National Guard, and so had my military responsibilities and obligations, as well as holding down a civilian job. And tough act to balance sometimes. I was a medic, and which I really loved, honestly. Me and being a medic clicked really well. And the medical field is just something I was super interested in. My uncle was a special operations medic, retired, and he kind of pushed me to make the jump. I was actually gonna join as an infantryman, and he told me that he would drive from I don't even know where he was, Washington State at the time, and beat the crap out of me if I joined as an infantryman. So he told me to be a medic, and that you'll have a lot more opportunities, and you'll actually be able to help the people in your community with the medical expertise. And I'm like, oh, you know, maybe you're right. And that was no easy path, for sure. I'm not an academically inclined person whatsoever. High school was a struggle for me, and medic school is a very academically demanding job, or MOS, as we call it, military occupational specialty. And I struggled bad, but I really fell in love with it, and I got out into the civilian world part of my military career, and started working as an EMT. I was at 18 years old. I was working trucks and running calls and all that. So kind of a jump head first into the deep end as an adult, for sure. Right out of high school. And just kind of one of those things, I rode the wave and kind of liked it and kind of didn't, and kind of just realized that it, like, I planned on getting married soon. My wife and I were wanting to get married, and we got married when we were, I was 19. She was 18 when we got married. And I was like, man, this isn't paying the bills. I mean, at the time, an EMT was making $11 an hour.
Oh, Jesus.
Horrible.
That's it? And,
yeah. Paramedic starting pay, I think, was like 14.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, horrible. I mean, it makes you really feel for the, unless you're part of a union or something like that, it definitely makes you feel for the private owned truck companies out there. Got guys doing that job, but the paperwork and everything else that came with the job just kind of sucked the life out of the glory of doing it, I guess you could say. And I'm like, man, I really got to make some money if I'm going to get married and whenever we wanted to. And so I talked to a buddy that worked at this commercial construction company, and I'm like, you think they're hiring? And he said, oh yeah, they're always hiring. And so it was not my first choice. And it's kind of a joke because years ago I said, I don't care what I do, I just don't want to work construction or something like that. And so the Lord definitely had a sense of humor there, because I jumped in feet first, and we weren't a union. It wasn't a union company. So you did everything, concrete, running equipment, forming, concrete form carpentry, framing and everything. You did literally all of it, the rebar, the steel work from beginning to end. So as far as exposure in the trades, anybody looking to go into the trades, I would definitely encourage them to maybe give the like the non-union companies like that at least a glance, just to see, because you're exposed to so much. So then by the time I left there and went to building houses, it was just full bore, chasing a passion and doing something that I loved. So
I mean, it sounds like you've just been like a driven guy since, the get-go, right? You're still a pretty young guy, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let's kind of curve this back into kind of like the outdoorsy and hunting and shooting and stuff. So, first of all, where are you? You're in Missouri, right?
Yeah, northeastern Missouri.
Okay. Is that kind of where you grew up, or?
Yeah, I'm still addressed to the same town I've lived in since day zero.
No kidding.
So homebody.
So growing up then, right? Hunting family, not a hunting family. I mean, how was that?
Yep, hunting family. My dad, he mostly just gun hunted. We would go hunting every year, like I would just go with him, tag along to begin with. And then it just kind of blew up from there. And I always remember, I think I was maybe four, something like that. And he shot the biggest buck he's ever shot in his life. And we had it hanging out. Actually, the house I live in now, I live in my grandparents' old house, that kind of one of the houses I grew up in, I was able to come back to with my family. And this big walnut tree out here in the yard had a big old chain gambrel on it. And that's where that was the deer pole out there. So
nice.
So there's pictures of me, and I still remember being out there and my dad laying that big old buck's head over my lap. And I just kind of been enamored ever since then, and just everything about deer and seeing deer. And we moved into the country when I was five, and it was a whitetail, kind of whitetail turkey mecca, the property we moved on to before the house was put there. But just exposure to wildlife and grandparents that hunted, I never had a chance.
you said your dad was a gun hunter then. So what kind of sparked the archery bug for you?
Well, my great grandpa, that had the house I live in now, he owned one of the first archery shops anywhere around back in the day, called Steve Sports Spot. And he was a founding member of the Mississippi Valley Archery Club. And the man always owned a recurve. Big into bow fishing. The man was a fisherman through and through. And so bow fishing was something that he really, really loved and enjoyed. And he killed a lot of deer over the years, in his younger years, with a bow as well. And but by the time that, I come around and knew him, I was very fortunate, I might add. I got to know pretty intimately most of my great grandparents, which is not a thing that most people are afforded, unfortunately. And so the wisdom of people like that, you know, that grew up in the Great Depression, World War II veteran, and super cool. But yeah, he the old recurve hanging on his wall kind of sparked the interest a little bit. But then my dad, or my mother's dad, for a birthday, I think it was, got me like what was that thing? You remember those real cheapy little bear all camouflage compounds that was like solid plastic wheels that you get, a kid or something like that? Mm-hmm. Well, they were like 25 pounds. Well, he's like the auction guru. The man lives at auction barns. And he found those little bows, and he likes deer hunting so much, he ought to, shoot this bow around or something, and stuff like that, because he bow hunted on and off all his life as well. And ever since that thing hit my hand, that little cheap, all camouflage, my parents still have it, bow with frayed out strings by the grace of God, those things didn't explode anytime I was shooting it. And every last stinking arrow that my dad had laying around from he'd growing up, kind of done like some, for just a little practice and stuff here and there. And I was flinging arrows all over Hell's Half Acre for sure with that little bow, and I was obsessed. It just never stopped. I just realized, just the instant satisfaction of, letting go of a string and watching the arrow fly through the air and hit what you're shooting at. It bit me hard and just never went away.
And then that was it. Just, did you do a lot of small game or anything like that kind of coming up, or did you just jump right into deer?
With a bow?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, yes and no. I started hunting whenever I was 6, probably. That was when I shot my first deer with a Winchester 94 lever action 30-30, like many people. I, without sounding braggy at all, I think I've been very fortunate that I've gone every season since my very first season, without being skunked, just cause a lot of ability to be able to go. But by the time I was 10, so after hunting for about 4 or 5 years, I got what was that first bow? A Browning Micromitus. I bet I wore my dad's ear off asking for that bow. I want that Micromitus bad. That thing is sharp. It had a camo, mossy oak breakup camo limbs and a black riser. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And they kind of scrimped and saved and got it for me for Christmas, and started shooting every squirrel that ever lived after that. I would hate to imagine how many arrows I lost just shooting at squirrels, and my friends making fun of me for it all the time.
Did your friends bow hunt too, or were you kind of like a rarity?
I would say my good buddy, that we've been friends, close friends for probably going on 20 years. He was always a bow hunter. I mean, he was the bow hunter. We would spend hours on the phone, while, we were both in school and stuff, just talking about bows, talking about arrows, talking about, all of it. And, we both were ate up, with the sick with it, as the, much younger people are saying nowadays. Like I said, it never went away, and we both just kind of kept fueling that fire for each other. So that connection kind of helped also keep the flame alive.
Nice. So first deer, when did the first deer come about with a bow?
I think I was 11, I believe, 11 or 12.
Wow.
I'm gonna say probably 12. I was. I had shot a deer the year before that, and lost it. I hit it in the shoulder and lost it, and didn't have another opportunity that year with a bow. And then the next year, I might add, too, I was homeschooled all the way through. So that did not help my my disease of bow hunting sure. at all, because, you know, I could come back from hunting in the mornings and do school or whatever. But anyway, it was November. I think I even remember the day, November the 9th. And it was a morning hunt, and I did some rattling and whatnot and looked up on top of the ridge and caught some movement. And I'm like, man, that must be, there have been some coons kind of flopping around up there on top of that ridge earlier in the morning. And I'm like, oh, it's just another one of those stinking coons. And I looked up and I saw the big flash of brown and a set of antlers jumping the fence that ran kind of to me down the ridge. And I said, oop, that's not a coon. And my dad, when I was young, of course, he wouldn't let me hunt out of a tree stand, which was probably a smart move. So I had to sit on the ground for all my hunting. And I kind of got stood up, slowly got stood up and grabbed my bow. I was leaning up. I was wearing a original mossy oak, like tree bark looking, or not mossy oak, sorry, the original real tree with the tree bark look,
yeah.
Wells coveralls. And so I probably blended into that tree, the big white oak tree I was leaning against that was probably 4 foot wide. I probably disappeared on that thing. And he ran right up to our property line, up to the fence at 20 yards away. And while I'm standing there on the ground, it jumped over that fence onto our side. And I'm shaking like a leaf, man, you know. And I had a prong arrow rest, and I was shooting an old Hoyt MT Sport bow with Easton Game Getter aluminum arrows and a prong arrow rest. And as I drew that bow back, it said across the arrow rest. I'm shaking so bad. And that deer whipped his head over, looked at me, and it was too late. I took a quartering two shot and kind of hit him in the neck a little bit, dropped him in his tracks. So he was a nice, you know, little like 1520 inch 2-year-old 10 point. And that was my first deer with a bow. And that set the pace for sure.
Nice. Was that a compound you said, or is that a recurve with a rest on it?
That was a compound.
Compound, yeah. Yeah. Those old, I think my first bow was a PSE Nova, right? Back in 98.
My dad had one.
Whatever. Yeah. And it had the two prong rest, you know, where like you could you know, had like the set screws, right? So they can go in and out, right? Like longitudinally, and then you can kind of twist them, right? So you can like twist each one of them like you know, inboard outboard kind of thing. But then they had a set screw. So once like this, you lock the set screw down in one position, of course it's got a dimple in it now, right? So anything after that, it immediately like wants to go like. It won't tighten up because it wants to go into that dimple, you know, and then just, yep. that was just like the worst thing. It was like the worst ever. It was just terrible. But yeah, no, I mean, back in the day. When did you kind of decide to swing back into the traditional realm there?
Like I said, I had grown up kind of watching, I think it was like a bonus. And I think it was like my first time actually like putting two and two together of the whole traditional bow hunting thing. I knew my grandpa had done it. He had an old recurve hanging in the basement and stuff, but it never like it piqued my interest per se until I think it was one of the old Primo's Truth Big Bucks DVDs back in the day. And it was an extra at the like a bonus footage like that you could go through in the main menu. And it was Fred Bear's Badland Bucks hunt, where he's chasing him and his buddy are chasing big mule deer there in the Badlands in South Dakota, and or North Dakota, one of the two. And watching that hunt was my first exposure to being like, wow, like, you know, like those guys went out there with those little sticks and strings and killed those things. And then I've always been enamored with Native American history and just everything about Native Americans and that culture and just that way of life, and something that also that we could, you know, maybe get into later or something that I kind of drifted back into as well. But But no, it's just whittling bows out of trees. A guy kind of told me about making my own bow, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. So I used and abused my dad's old draw knife and probably made 2,000 freaking little sapling bows and broke them and made a new one. And then I didn't actually start hunting with one until probably 10 or 12 years ago. I started actually taking one out hunting. And the first year that I took one, I was hunting on the ground, kind of on where a logging road comes down out of some big timber into a field bottom. And I was sitting in the grass off that road, like maybe 5 yards. And I'd been there for a couple days and doing that. And finally a big doe come walking down that road. And I was sitting on my knees in that grass, and I had a PSE, some kind of PSE longbow. I can't remember what it was. So I was way too heavy, like, you know, 50, 55 pounds, something like that. And,
yeah.
And no arrows that weren't even tuned, you know, didn't know jack all about tuning or, you know, the depths and ins and out of archery, anything, even a compound probably up until I was, you know, almost an adult. But I raised up off on my knees at 5 yards and pulled back and shot that doe hit her in the shoulder or hit her in the humeral head, something, hit her, somewhere solid. I didn't get much penetration. I never did find her, but that kind of stuck with me because for one, I felt unsettled. I felt like, you know, that was kind of the next step for me. I'd killed so many deer already with a compound by that point. I'm like, I need to, you know, I want to be able to say that I killed one with a stick bow. And so I felt really unsettled about that, and not only about losing the deer, but just like, man, I was that close and like that kind of a rush and with this traditional bow and everything, and I screwed it up. So I continually tried on and off for several years following that, and always kind of played with one, always kind of flung some arrows around and tried to get half decent with it, and missed a nice buck with it one time at like, oh, probably 20 yards. So that kind of burned me a little, but that was the start. So that's how I got bit with the bug. And then, it sounds kind of corny, if you will, but, I was with the carpentry thing. I'm sure you have ways that you were like that as well. There's something that just fits you better as a person.
Yeah.
Fits your personality better. Fits your approach better. Fits the way that you go about things, your mindset. Just fits you better. And I always felt like in the back of my head that just I should shoot a traditional bow. I was always so, like I said, enamored with Native American culture, and Fred Bear was, I mean, I was obsessed with his old hunting videos, and I'm like, you know, like I'm the kind of guy that I could safely say that if I could get good enough at it to feel comfortable with it, I would give up a compound, because that to me is, I mean, not to offend anybody listening, but that to me is bow hunting, you know, like that is not only bow hunting, but hunting, to a very historical ancient, level. You're grabbing the weapon with your hands, you're grabbing the string with your fingers, and you have to be close, you know? And so I just knew that fit me better, and that if I could find an avenue, if I could find a way, then I would make the switch and probably never look back. But yeah, that was kind of the beginnings of everything.
So when was the last year that you finally decided, all right, no more compound at all? I mean,
2 years ago, was my last time with a compound. I even sold the darn thing. I was so convinced that this was it. If I give myself no other options, then I have to get good at it. You know, I have to make it work. And sure, sometimes that's the way my brain works. Like, I have to give myself no out except forward. And that was one of those situations. And I sold my compound. I borrowed from my dad. He had, a Red Wing Hunter. Red Wing was made by Bob Lee Bose back in the day. A little Red Wing Hunter, 58 inch bow, 50 pound draw. And I found a guy in town that he actually competed, like he would do do instinctive shooting competitions and stuff like that. And I just went over and spent a whole afternoon at his house, and he kind of confirmed or reassured, or reproof, rebuke, sort of a thing of whatever I was doing at the time, to kind of set me on a good trajectory. And I'm like, okay, like, you know, this gives me some of the keys that I need, because I mean, I don't know how it is where you live, but it's kind of hard to find guys that shoot trad, you know.
Yeah, there's a small contingent here, but there's not a ton. Unfortunately, there's more people that shoot crossbows now than traditional.
Oh my gosh, yeah, we won't get into all that unless we have a lot more time. It's hard around here. It's very difficult to find guys that shoot trad. I can count easily on one hand all the guys I know that shoot trad. It's very, very few. No formal clubs or anything like that. So this having this guy as an outlet was a huge kind of saving grace there. Like, I know somebody, and this guy is, and he started telling me, he's like, he kind of helped enlighten me too. Like, you got to get close, you know, like, don't worry about, because I'm used to shooting. I shot a deer one time with a compound at 75 yards.
Oh, man.
And multiple shots over 40, kill shots over 40 yards. And, fairly would say that I was definitely an above average shooter with a compound before I came down with a gosh awful case of target panic. But he's like, don't worry about, you know, the fact that you're limited, just get close. He's like, I set myself up in spots that I have to be, you know. I put myself on the ditch crossings, you know, I put myself on the main trail, you know, I want to be able to see their eyelashes when I draw my bow back, you know. And I'm like, it can be done. I felt confident enough in my skills that I'm like, oh, well, I can make that happen. I can get close. So I just need to get the bow part down. And I just abused myself, really. I succeeded by volume. I destroyed my fingers. My fingers were black and blue. Nose bled from the string hitting my nose, and shot my basement every night as much as I possibly could, pretty well the physical exhaustion. And November 1st, I think it was November 1st of that season, I had a doe come in to 15 yards, and I was able to put an arrow in her and take her. And that was the first official whitetail that I'd shot and recovered with that stick bow. And
What was that feeling like?
That's, like I said, not trying to be cheesy, it's kind of hard to describe. It's kind of hard to put into words. Like, I'd shot so many deer with a compound. And so to know what, like I mentioned earlier, that this is where I should be. Like, holding that stick bow in my hand, and like I said, it sounds really corny, but walking out to your tree stand and looking at that thing, that you're carrying that thing out there to chase deer, it's like, wow, you know, like, this is real, you know, like, this is hunting, you know. I'm going to shoot something with no sights and make it happen. And it was a flood of emotions when she went crashing off through the brush. It's probably a feeling I hadn't had since that first buck that I shot, you know, at 18 yards on the ground. Just a flood of emotions, and kind of like a, you know, all this hard work paid off sort of a thing, you know, satisfaction. And and never looked back. So
yeah, that's awesome. So like, we can kind of fast forward a little bit now. So like, I mean, you basically, it sounds like you've had
throughout like your hunting career, right? I mean, you've kind of done it all. You've done it on the ground. You've done it with a compound. You've done it with, I don't know if you said anything with rifles or not, but, yeah. You know, you've done it with, you know, stick bows and stuff. So you've kind of, and we all evolve, right? So, mm-hmm. but it sounds like you've kind of like evolved and, I hate using that term because it sounds cheesy, like your craft, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, it sounds like, you know, every year we learn something new, we throw away things that don't work, we try new things. I mean, do you feel right now that, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of stupid to say, like, kind of you're like the best hunter you've ever been kind of thing. I mean, do you still have that same level of like supreme confidence going in? Or, I mean, do you have like ups and downs with your, I don't know, with your seasons, with your shooting, with everything? I mean, how's that now?
As far as where I'm at, I would say that every year I've progressively, I feel like been a better hunter when I walk in the woods and a better person. And I would say that it's kind of, this is the beginnings of the peak of my truly bow hunting career. Cause I mean, yeah, as far as gun hunting, I've kind of taken and left gun hunting. I've taken a lot of deer with a rifle, granted. It's the ratio there of gun kills to bow kills, just, you know, in the time that I've been in the woods, it's pretty ridiculous. I think I punched my 32nd bow tag this last season, in Missouri, with a bow. And, going out and being intentional, going out with a mission, like not like, I hope I can do this, but going out like, this is how it works for me. And this is what I got to make happen, and making it happen, people get all butt hurt when you say it, but with such limited capabilities, I would say that, yeah, this is the beginning, kind of the beginning of my height for sure. By shooting a stick bow and, you know, I'll add, like I said, that first deer I shot instinctive, and the guy that kind of taught me is like, yeah, you shoot instinctive. And like Fred Berry, you know, you shoot instinctive, but, I had to find my own way, when it came to shooting a stick bow, because, and a lot of people do, you know, it's a very personal thing. And that's why I think that's why I've started that uphill climb to, you know, the peak for me, because I feel like I found my way. I feel like I've accomplished, honestly, I've accomplished to a point where I'm comfortable. I won't ever be totally satisfied, but I've reached a level where I'm sustainable, and I know that, you know, I can take this current situation or this current style of hunting and be successful with it. All I got to do is be in the right place at the right time. So yeah, it's forced me to level up and step up my game in a lot of areas, not just the shooting side of it. I scout harder. I run trail cameras harder. I do a lot of stuff to make sure that I am in the right place at the right time. So yeah, it's by proxy. It's leveled me up in a lot of different aspects.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly, opens up more of that experience than just, sitting around waiting for something to come by, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think anyone that hunts with a tradition, or at least anyone that hunts like really, really close, you know what I mean? You just got up that whole like woodsmanship game, and it's not just the journey of learning to shoot one of these things. It's the journey of what comes with it because you're shooting one of these things, you know,
yes.
If that makes any sense. So that's also
intimate.
I think that, I'm going to generalize the crossbow people that, I shoot rifle. Right. But, mm-hmm. It's not the same. It's not the same. No. When I go a field with, you know, I'm actually like holding my ASL right now. I'm kind of playing around with it, you know, this in my hand versus my 30-06, you know what I mean? But it's the whole, and you know, and sometimes like, I know we sit here and say like, this might be controversial, but you know, we're like, oh, we need to get more people into this. We need to get more people hunting, whether it's traditional or not traditional or whatever. But like, part of me is like, you know what, like, this is something special that I don't necessarily want to share with like, everybody in the world, which is odd because you and I both have YouTube channels, right?
Right.
I don't know. I think certain things are just like, kind of like, okay, this is like a special thing that only certain people understand. and I don't know, maybe you just don't want to invite everyone to the party. I don't know. Does that sound kind of elitist?
No. And here's the thing. My mentors, as far as if you call them mentors, never met the people, you know, but you know what I'm talking. My role models, guys like Fred Bear, Aldo Leopold, Theodore Roosevelt, and someone that many people probably know a name, many people probably know, Donnie Vincent. Mm-hmm. Those people and their approach to the woods and to wildlife and to their love for what they do, you find that same mindset and characteristic very strongly in the traditional community. That love for the wildlife, and it's like I said, like you said, we're gonna rock some boats here a little bit, but you just don't find that in the general hunting community, the general bow hunting community. And it's nothing against the guys that shoot wheel bows or whatever. It's whatever you're into, whatever makes you, you know, freaking happy. But by and large, everybody that you talk to that shoots traditional has that mindset. They give a crap. You know what I'm saying? They're out there. They know they're limited. They know they can't take the shot unless it's close. But they can take the shot or leave it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if they don't want to kill that animal, like someone that's really refreshing for me to watch is Robert Carter. You been watching any of his videos on YouTube?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He was on like a few episodes ago too. Yeah.
Oh, he was. I missed that.
I love that guy. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's somebody that I would love to go hook up with and do some hunting, because that mindset, like when did we get away from calling animals like pretty, we went from, you know, guys like Theodore Roosevelt and Fred Bear and Aldo Leopold to now everyone's like, oh, you know, stupid does, that SOB, like I'm gonna kill her first chance I get. No, this is like, where does this stuff come from, you know? And and then you hear the traditional guys like, man, you know, I was out here and, you know, saw that, you know, this doe snuck in on me, she got, you know, she's a smart old girl, she got downwind of me and got my wind, but you know, I'm just glad I got to see something. And you know, they're you know, they're real pretty, you know, with sun rising up behind them and everything. It was, you know, she was a pretty little doe and this and that. And, maybe I'll get an opportunity or something. That's that approach of just love for the wildlife and love for the outdoors and what you're doing and not having to kill something. You're out there with that stick bow, knowing that you're limited because you love the hunt. You know, you love what you're immersed in, the lifestyle, the wildlife. You know, I never felt like whenever until I was introduced to Donnie Vincent and realized that, you know, that's he and I align in a lot of ways, that I can watch a deer walk by, even if it's something that I would normally shoot, and with that stick bow well within range, whatever, and take it or leave it. Like I can watch that animal walk under me, whatever, buck, doe, doesn't matter, and feel satisfaction just enjoying the chase, you know. And and even if they skirt by me out of range, you're like, man, that was cool, you know, I saw this big old buck, you know. I don't think about the fact of whether I had a compound or not. I kind of got past that. But you're forced to watch, you know, you're forced to immerse yourself in nature and in wildlife. And I think that's just what makes our community very, very special as a whole. And you find, I think, a lot more of your, it's kind of a bold statement, but you find a lot more of your true hunters, you know, like the guys that care. Those guys generally are carrying a stick bow. And for what it's worth, and we're going to, you know, so we're talking about mindsets, Donnie Vincent, in case if you haven't noticed or paid attention, Donnie Vincent has taken up traditional archery as well.
Yeah, I see him dabbling. Yeah.
Because of the same things we're talking about, he said, how much, you know, you can't get any more intimate with the animals that you're chasing than, you know, such an ancient way of hunting, you know. And as far as giving the animal a chance, you know, I'm not bloodthirsty. I don't have to go out there and kill something just because I see it. And maybe that's why, you know, we're kind of the same way with gun hunting. You know, it just doesn't have that allure. You know, I like the chase. I like to see them close. I like to be forced to slow down and watch, if that makes any sense.
Oh, perfect sense. Absolutely perfect sense. You know, yeah. And it's the little things too. I mean, how many, let's say gun hunters or even a lot of compound guys. I mean, how many of you know, how many of you, if you were to ask them, hey, you know, what does a blue jay sound like and why are they doing what they're doing? Like, how many can, are they going to, how many can actually answer you? You know what I mean? Like, they're just, and that's just one little tiny example, right? Of like paying attention in the woods and just being part of it rather than just kind of sitting there trying to snipe something from, you know, well, even like you said, like 75 yards away.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, yeah, it's, and not that there aren't like, you know, people that, in the compound world or whatnot that are, that don't share these values. It's just, it seems like in this community, there are more of them, you know, just because of, just, I don't know, because of the way we hunt and where we have to hunt and how we have to do it and all that kind of stuff. So, you know,
yeah,
100%. So, so good segue here. So where do you hunt? I mean, you said you had a farm, are you private land, you public land? I mean, what's your approach? What's your, you know, you're running gun guy.
Right now, primarily, I hate to say it because nowadays it almost kind of sounds like rubbing it in people's face. Right now, I'm mostly on private land. It's becoming a struggle, you know. I've got this arbitrary goal of I really want to shoot a mature buck on public land. That's something I've never done. I've killed deer on public land, killed turkeys on public land. I've never killed a nice buck on public land. So that's something I'm going to dabble, try to dabble more in this year. But as far as just my day to day, my key to success is just simplicity. I'm a very minimalist, almost to a religious, level, minimalist, simple, you know, in my approach towards things. I know where the deer exit, you know, and enter into my property, and I have a ladder stand there. I only hunt it on a certain wind. And, if I'm going to see deer, they're going to be in range. You know, that's just kind of that's kind of how that spot is set up. So it puts me in a, by proxy, into a lot of good situations. But, as far as like, you know, my style, if I'm just on the back 40, if you will, ladder stands, seem to be more than adequate for me. And as far as the run and gun stuff, I want to get into that, but there's nothing out there that, and it sounds kind of maybe closed-minded, but there's nothing out there that fits my style, fits my needs, fits the way that I do things, except for just finding a spot to brush in and sit on the ground. You know, I've tried using the climbers. I hate having to try to find a tree to climb. I don't hate carrying that crap in on my back. The saddles thing, I know everybody's really going hard at the whole saddles deal, but I just can't buy into it. I can't make myself buy into that thing, into that trend or whatever, if you will. There's just nothing out there that really works for me, except for just I take way more pleasure. And maybe it's just because I've had so many opportunities, whether it's deer I shot or not. Being on the ground with deer at their eye level, that's what gets my juices going. That's what makes me want to go back. That's what keeps me coming back, being in close at eye level, where I'm having to draw at the right time, having to sit in the right spot, find the shadows, brush in, whatever. And you know, say the whole Native American thing too, you know, that's just kind of where I go. And I find more freedom in that, like too, like, as far as mobile hunting, it doesn't get much more mobile than just, you know, a little fanny pack around your waist or something and just rolling out and finding a nice deadfall to set in or whatever, you know. So that's kind of my style. That's kind of what I accept and call my niche.
So let's talk about your ground setup then, because I do like a mix of everything, right? Tried to saddle. I still have a saddle, but I use it to like climb with, because I do like one stick climbing and stuff most of the times. But I'm kind of back to the tree stand. Never been 100% like super happy in a tree stand anyway. Some people are just so comfortable in one, right? This past season and a half, I've gotten way more comfortable in it. But I mean, plus I'm fidgety, right? So like if I'm on the ground, I feel like I can like kind of get up and move, and just kind of like literally I'm not happy right here. I'm just going to get up and make a shift over there or whatever. Where sometimes in a tree stand, you feel like, all right, I went through all this effort, I'm committed, you know, when you really should get down and move. Right. But for as far as ground setups, right? I mean, what works for you? I mean, I think I've seen you in a couple of your videos do like the ghillie thing and stuff like that. But let's say you're going on public, right? So you say you do minimalist, but when you're going on public, it's a little different, I'm guessing, right? For what you carry, because like, what do you do if you shoot something on public? Number one, number two, like, what do you go in with as your setup, and how do you set it up, and what's your approach?
Well, every time I hit the woods, and this started last summer, doing more bushcrafting type of stuff, and then I just drag it over into hunting. I take what's called, I call it a woodsman's belt pouch. A woodsman or hunter's belt pouch is something that's been around since the 18th century. The hunters and they had a belt pouch. And so I went from a leather one with a kind of like an antler tip kind of string closure thing on it, which would be period correct about that turn, you know, the 18th, 19th century. Went with that, and just kind of carried some minimal stuff. I carry a fire starter. I always carry a Bic lighter. I don't actually leave my house ever without a Bic lighter in my pocket. So I got a lighter in there, have a quick fire, something to start a fire quick, have some 550 paracord, a small hank of that, about 25 feet. And every one of those things has a plethora of uses, especially the paracord. You know, if you're needing to brush in or something like that, you can tie and lash and whatever.
Tie stuff. Yeah.
Yep. And then a belt knife, a fixed blade belt knife. That's for the most part it. I also carry an SAK or a Swiss Army knife. That's a very handy thing I think everybody should have. And if you want the list of all this, if any of the viewers want the list of this stuff, they can actually go back and watch my video that I did last year called the Woodsman's Belt Pouch. And it talks about all that stuff. But as far as a pack, if I am going on public land and I'm outside of dragging range, if there's any chance I'm going to have to break a deer down, I take a pack. Mm-hmm. Empty with game bags. That's all that's in it. So when I say minimalist, if I'm going a mile from my truck on public land, the only thing different from what I would have on me on the back 40 is a pack with some game bags in it. And as far as the setup itself, people could learn a lot more by just really getting more serious with case study and understanding whitetails and just the animals themselves. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about what they see, how nervous they are, what makes them comfortable, uncomfortable, whatever. And you could really go on and on with some people about it. But I'm the kind of person, I journal stuff. I take notes of things that I've seen. I'm able to kind of put things away in the thought bank of what I've experienced over the years, what this deer did this when I did this. So I either can or can't do that anymore, or I need to change the setup just a little bit, tweak it, whatever. But you can get away, at least in Missouri. I know different states are different. Michigan deer are, you know, wired like a Red Bull, like they've drank a can of Red Bull or, you know, whatever. You know, you people have heard stories of guys scooting their boot across their stand just right, and every deer within the zip code, you know, runs off. But the amount of you can get away with a lot more movement than you think. Camo is not a necessity. I'm notorious for wearing plaid shirts. A lot of it's just because I'm a kind of spiteful person. I wear plaid and old mismatched camo on purpose. Mm-hmm. Just to make waves, because that's kind of how I roll. But I have killed multiple deer wearing red plaid shirts. I've killed them on the ground wearing plaid shirts. Had them look right at me, walk within 5 yards on the ground, you know, just sit butt on the ground, leaning against the tree, looking right at me, you know, with a plaid shirt, no face mask. None of that, just tan pants and plaid shirt, and never know I was anywhere in the area, you know. So
what do you do with your eyes? Are you a squinter? What do you do?
Yeah, I tend to be kind of a squinter, kind of a look downer, kind of like squint and kind of look at my, you kind of look at the ground a little bit just so I don't make eye contact. But
yeah.
Because it's funny, I actually experimented a lot of stuff. You'd be surprised how much I learned just from ground hunting squirrels. And how squirrel, just the behavior of a squirrel, you know, like a gray squirrels can be super pesky. You know, they sit up there and won't shut up for, you know, minutes on end as soon as they see you in your tree stand or whatever. If you don't make eye contact with them, you could be scratching your head, you know, swatting mosquitoes, whatever. You could be, you know, look like a 200-pound gorilla in that tree. But if you don't make eye contact with them, you just kind of blow them off and act like they're not there. They'll shut up and go away. And deer aren't exactly to that level, but if you just don't move and don't make eye contact with them, you can get away with murder, you know. And people talk about fletching colors and all this and that, like, I have yet to any color of something that I've worn into the woods. I don't wear, like, obviously neon or something like that, but camo is just not necessary. And this is coming from someone that ground hunts. It helps if you don't have a spot you can brush in real well. That leafy suit is an incredible piece of equipment. And that's, I guess, one thing I lied a little bit. That's one thing I will carry in the very bottom of my pack. I will take that leafy suit with me if I can't set in a spot where I like the shadows and kind of if I'm don't feel like I'm out of sight, out of mind, I will put that on. But yeah, just... You don't have to be confined, you know, to a tree stand. You don't have to be confined to a ground blind. You don't have to be confined to any of that. You know, putting yourself in the shadows, putting yourself out of sight, out of mind, learning how to let animals walk past you and not freak out as soon as you see one. Just kind of remaining, you know, Mr. Calm, cool, and collected. You'd be really surprised at the kind of success that you can have just hunting on the ground, wearing a plaid shirt and tan pants or whatever, and how close deer will get to you, totally oblivious to your existence. And that's way more of a rush too. So that's probably part of the reason I like it so much.
Sure. So you mentioned a leafy suit. Is it like a actual leafy or is it a ghillie? Like, or do you notice a difference? Have you tried both of them?
I haven't tried both of them. I've only really tried that leafy suit that looks like a laser cut Cabela's leafy mm-hmm. suit. That seems to be enough. And like I said, that I can't honestly sit here and tell you that there's been a time where I'm like, man, if I had that leafy suit on, that deer would be dead. I can't even really say that. Like it's that minimal, the effects that I've seen from the whitetails to my presence. It's so minimal that I can't honestly say that, like, man, if I'd had that leafy suit on, that sucker had been, you know, gonzo. It's if they bust me, it's because they came in behind me. You know, like last season, I was sitting on a 5-gallon bucket with a swivel seat and kind of down in a ditch on the side of a field where, you know, they come walking down the side of the field and I'm down in this ditch and kind of had an ambush going. And, it was 3:00 in the afternoon in September and I hear a boom, I hear a stomp, foot stomp. And I'm like, oh gosh. And I look up and you know, this doe is already, she's seeing me jacking around with my tripod and, you know, jacking around with my setup and all this. Cause it's 3:00 in the afternoon. I'm not expecting her to be there. And,
yeah,
you know, unless it's a situation like that and, you know, I don't even think the leafy suit would help then, you know, it's, so as far as the difference, no, I don't really see one. It's really about your setup and where you place yourself and learning to just keep your cool until that deer walks past you or puts its head down or looks away from you, you know, learning those little behavioral idiosyncrasies of the whitetails.
Yeah.
and when to draw, you know, that to me has proved to be way more important than the leafy suit or camo in general.
It's like what's that Fred Bear quote about, you know, the best camouflage is sit down, be quiet, and don't move.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's so simple. I mean, it really is. And I'll be honest with you, you know, I'm sure I probably lost some followers from this because I'm pretty blatant about it. I'm very anti-commercialization of hunting. I think the commercialization of hunting, just from what I knew hunting to be as a kid to what it is now, we've really lost touch. It's we've gone from providing from our families, enjoying the pursuit. We've gotten of hunting and just into what hunting is supposed to be. We've drifted so far away from that for the sake of, paying someone a certain amount to wear a certain camo, you know, just to sell it. And I have a big moral dilemma with that. It's something that really bothers me. It really chaps me, and it makes me worry about the future of hunting. And so some of it might be just like I said, a spiteful thing. You don't need half of the stuff that people are telling you that you need. That's why I'm so minimalist. I've really made it, like I said, a mission of mine to take my years of experience to find out what you absolutely need and to carry things in the woods with you that have multiple uses, you know, so you're not carrying this, you know, 20-pound bag of garbage into your tree stand every day.
That's me. I always joke that I pack like a girl, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, man, I'm gonna cut down. And I'm like, you know, I drink a lot of water, like Gatorade or something, right? So I'm like, immediately, mm-hmm. Right off the top, I got like two of those things in there, and then I've got this, and I've got that, then I've got, it's gonna get chilly, so I'm gonna wear this, and then it's my hat, and then if my deer hunt turns into a small game hunt, you know, as it frequently does, into a squirrel hunt, then I gotta have, you know, my orange on, because I gotta hunt with orange on for that one, but, you know, and pretty soon I'm like, I'm carrying a freaking 1800 cubic inch backpack all the time, you know, and I've tried getting away from it, and I know it can be done for sure, because everyone
it can, but it's hard.
No, I just can't let go.
It is hard. Yep, I've been that guy too. I mean, I'm not gonna say it. I've always been a minimalist. It's been in probably the past 5 years or so that I've really gotten religious about it. But it's hard. Yeah, you know, you sound like you're more on necessity, though. You know, like you said, if you want your deer hunt turn into a squirrel hunt or something like that, or like you said, you're guzzling water. That makes a difference. You know, that I wouldn't nick against that like I would, you know, the guy that takes his propane heater, his rattling bag, his grunt tubes, is this, and you know.
But like, I am the guy that's like the I like backups, right? Because I'm like,
yeah,
you know, one is none, two is one kind of thing. So I'm like, all right, here's my backup flashlight, and here's my backup batteries to my backup flashlight. And here's So I've gotten better. I've gotten way better. But, you know, then it's also a case of it's like, well, if I shoot something back here, then I'm not dragging. Right.
Yep.
So here in Minnesota, we can quarter out. You got to go back and get the carcass, which is absolutely stupid. But, yeah. You know, there's no way in some of these areas I'm going that I'm going to be able to drag anything out of where I am.
You're not willing to Dan Infault it and drag a sled all the way 3 miles back into a marsh.
He's an absolute. I mean, and he's the same way. He's like, I've got a compass and sometimes a knife.
Yep.
You know, and I'm like, yeah, I can't, dude. And he's happy like wading through like, you know, swamp water up to his nipples. You know, I'm like, no.
Not me either. But yeah, and as far as the minimalist thing, like I said, it's hard. And like again, the commercialization and the industry, it definitely hasn't helped that. I think it tells 9 out of 10 people that they need things that they don't.
Yeah.
Just to get someone a paycheck, so someone can get a slice of the pie, you know, out of an animal being killed. But it's freeing. The freeingness that I feel of just snapping my little fanny pack around my waist that's got, you know, my woodsman's belt kit in it, and I run a binaural harness. I'm a huge believer in a binaural harness, not just because it's a fad, because it's a practical piece of equipment, and I run a Sitka mountain harness now, and I, you know, I have the tab. I have a spare tab. I have a spare bowstring, you know, stuff like that, you know. But it's, like I said, it's freeing. You know, instead of me slinging this heavy pack over my back to go to the back 40 or whatever, you know, I feel very confident in this very hand, you know, small amount of things that I'm taking back there that I can get back to my truck, or maybe I have something in my truck that I can upgrade to, or whatever. You know, it And that's part of the reason, and some people probably the reason they don't subscribe to me, because I suck at capturing shots on camera. It's not my priority. And my wife's asked me about it, like, why don't you make sure you're recording and all this and that or whatever. I'm like, because if I get it, I get it. But if not, this is my sanctuary. This is where I find peace. Like, this bow hunting, it sounds corny, but it's who I am. You know, it's a huge part of me. It's one of my first loves, and it's where I find peace. It's a lot of things to me that, you know, some can't even be put into words, but
it's funny. You sound like a mountain man out of time. You know what I mean? Like, just some of the way you approach some of these things and the things you're saying, you know, like, you pretty much describe like what they used to call a possibles bag, right? Back in the mountain man days kind of thing. So that's good though. That's refreshing. Cause I think more of that people need to see, rather than, you know, whack them, stack them, you know, 20 kills in 15 minutes kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? So I want to get back to this, cause it sounds like it's pretty important to you. You mentioned, a lot of stuff about like Native American, like history and, you know, just the way that they used to do things. So where did that come from? Like what sparked that, interest for you?
Probably Davy Crockett movies. I don't know if have you ever seen the old Disney movie, Light in the Forest?
No.
It's a really good movie. It's about a young, it's a white kid that was captured by Indians as a child. And then during the 7 Years' War, the French Indian War, while British still had control of the United States at the time, they were working with the local tribes to all these kids that have been captured over the years, some of them adults, some of them married to members of the tribe, you know, and they're kind of taking them back and returning them to their families, as part of this treaty deal. That's kind of what it's based around, but just, and reading, Daniel Boone's book, and a book about his life, and, just, and the mountain men is, it's funny you mentioned mountain men. That's probably one of the, sick dreams that I have, is that I wish that I could rewind time and just been a mountain man, you know, right. You can imagine, you know, if you've ever been to Yellowstone, you know, what it must have been like for a big bearded fellow on a horse to see that, lay eyes on all that for the first time with no roads, no telephone poles, nothing, just, you know, God's country. But anyway, just their way of life, the self-sufficiency, they lived off the land, so they're intimate with the land. And that's something that I don't lose touch of now. And it's such an integral part of who I am and how I approach the woods, because I don't believe in taking what you don't need. I have some beef with conservation departments about that, you know, and we could go into the whole, you know, crossbow deals and all that. But management of whitetails is a term that's used to cover up just
money generation.
Money generation and generating the industry and keeping a population in check, but helping people to understand. And that's the kind of the Indian way of life, or the Native American way of life, that just because the state tells you you can kill all these does and all these bucks and everything doesn't mean you should, you know. Right. don't take what you don't need. And it honestly, it's kind of one of those things that maybe it's funny to say, maybe old age is hitting me early, but I feel guilty if I don't think I would let myself take an animal unless it was for a darn good reason. And that's where Donnie Vincent is. That's a man that I could listen to for hours and hours and hours and hours, because it's like listening to my brain being recorded, you know, with somebody else's, you know, in somebody else's body, talking. I truly believe that he kind of has embraced that way of life as well, that Native American motto of living off, you know, of caring about the land, conserving your resources, and only taking what you need. The man said something that I it was a hard pill for me to swallow, but I've learned to come to grips with it and agree. If they were to come to us and tell us, or we were to mutually agree that we know animal population will indefinitely sustain itself, they're not going to eat themselves out of house and home, they're not going to spread disease, the livestock market is sustainable for the foreseeable future, we're not going to worry about meat, there's no more reason to kill wild animals, I would hang up my bow in a heartbeat, you know. And I think we should all be that way, you know. That's, and I think that's part of that, you know, Native American mindset, you know. If the resource is there, and I don't, even if the resource is there, if I don't need it, I'm not going to take it. And then just, I mean, just the way that this, you know, how the way they moved through the woods, you know, the way that they, you know, had to do certain things just to survive. I mean, I hear stories about, you know, the plain. I can only imagine what, like, the Navajo and tribes that lived in the deserts and in the high deserts, you know, like, you go to those places and you're like, how could any population or, you know, thrive off of this? But they did, you know, and maybe it's that simplistic side of me that connects with them so much that, like, I wish we could learn. It's, I mean, it's obviously wishful thinking, but I wish we could learn, as a whole, how to be less wasteful and embrace more of that mindset of, you know, they lived so simply and, they thrived, tremendously, you know, that they weren't hungry. It's kind of comical. I mean, there's enough pictures out there of, you know, like in the 1800s of, you know, captured Native Americans and whatever, like, some of them fellas were chunky.
When they're squatting there, you know, sitting there, what they call Indian style, right? You know, crisscross applesauce kind of thing. And they got Buddha bellies going on. Like, You know, must have been a good year on the plains.
Yep, that fellow was not struggling. And that's the thing. We have such an easy life too, you know. That wasn't surviving for them. They just didn't know any better.
No, that was life. Like, that's what they do.
Yeah. Like, good Lord, I mean, we're never more than 24 hours away from being back to that, you know. Like, look at what happens when people don't have their power and their internet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, it's just that, just the simplicity, just the purity, the rawness, how they went about themselves. And funny story, we can talk about equipment too if you want, but people, you know, I hear people say over the years, like, oh, it's not the way the, I bet that's not how the Indians did it. And I bet they didn't worry about tuning their arrows and FOC and all this. And like, no, like, it's, if you look at some of the equipment that was used, especially the Eastern Indians, which, I mean, arguably those were some of your oldest tribes, you know, that started from the Mississippians and all that, they had cane arrow shafts, river cane arrow shafts, but the front third of the shaft had hardwood, like oak or something like that. So that tells me that they will, for one, understood that I need to be able to shoot this arrow more than once, so it needs to be durable. But it also needs to be able to, like, it needs to be able to steer itself well enough to get, you know, penetrate that animal and drive that stone point in. So you take thousands of years worth of these people, you know, testing and you know, and trying these different things.
Literally tribal knowledge, right? Literally the term tribal knowledge. Yes,
passed down generations to generations to generations. And then one day, and it's not like we can all talk about the whole aiming and instinctive thing too. You cannot sit here, you know, you'd be lying through your teeth if someone sat in front of me and said that that the Indians didn't use their arrows somehow to aim. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm like? I'm sure there's some of them that shot instinctive because it worked for them. But I mean, these guys took their bows to the grocery store. You know what I'm saying? There was no IGA or Walmart on the corner. These guys grabbed their bows and went, you know, grocery shopping. So they had to hit what they were aiming at, and they were darn good at hitting what they aimed at. So you can't tell me that there wasn't a lot of them that figured out, hey, you know, if I just look down that arrow, I'm going to kind of figure out where it's going. And if I hold it about right here, the tip of the arrow about right there, I bet it's going to hit about right there. So for people to use the argument about, you know, like, and almost it's almost insulting to their intelligence, you know, to think that they didn't understand these things and that maybe they didn't understand, they didn't have a word for it, but FOC. Yeah. And and maybe this goose feather didn't work, you know, jack all for steering my arrow. Let me try a turkey feather. Let me try three feathers or four feathers or shorter or longer. You know, look at the different, all the different styles of points that they used, you know. That,
of course.
They understood, you know, they knew. And so, yeah, that's a lot of my interest. It's just a lot of untapped knowledge that we could still learn from them, especially as traditional bow hunters, because they're, you know, the kings of traditional bow hunting on our continent. But I think the child part of us, I think the inner child in us, that's what we're all, as traditional bow hunters, that's what we're really, you know, that's the real, maybe one of the real reasons we're doing it anyways, because, you know, like, that's how the Indians did it. I can do it this way too, so.
It's been done, so why can't, yeah. No, you make a really good point about the, I guess, the need to conserve ammo, right? It's the same thing. It's not like they can be like, you know, it's like if we go to a 3D shoot, I lost a few arrows, you know. I'm just going to, you know, dial up, you know, Three Rivers or whatever, and, you know, have a fresh dozen, you know, shafts on the way.
Can you imagine being a poor old Indian out there hunting and bust one of your arrows?
That's gotta be hard.
I'd be so crestfallen.
I'm making a new one, you know.
I would have to go back to my wigwam or my wiki up, and my wife would have to massage my head because I'd be having a stress panic attack, and I'd be dreaming about that arrow. I'd vomit a little, probably, you know.
Yeah. kind of reminds me of you know, you ever hear kind of young kids that grew up in the Depression era? You know, they're like, okay, well, we've got, you know, grandpappy's old 22 short. And, you know, my dad gave me like literally like five shells in my pocket to go hunting. And, mm-hmm. and my job was to get squirrels for dinner. And they damn well better be headshots. And yep. I better not miss, because ammo is because you're basically you're buying food with that ammo. Right. I mean, it's those five little tiny shells are probably cost, you know, at the time. Very, very, you know, as far as value, you know, high value. So make it count. So it's got to be the same way with,
with
the Native Americans and stuff, when they're like, you know, with the amount of just the work that goes into building one. And like you said, footing one and tempering one. And yeah, it's.
And then to cap it all off, if I don't make this shot, if I don't do my part right, you know, do the Eeyore walk back to the truck or whatever and go home and try it again another day. But if I don't make this right, if I don't execute mission and do this to the best of my abilities, we don't eat.
Yeah. Well, the village doesn't eat.
Yep.
And then you're really looked upon poorly by everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
can't shoot. Yeah.
What's that joke they have going around that vegetarian's Indian word for poor hunter?
Poor hunter. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Exactly. All right. So just to kind of, I guess we can kind of start to wrap it up here, but I do want to talk about your gear, right? Mm-hmm. I know you, like you said, you're minimalist in every other way. I've watched a bunch of your videos, and I know you are a tuner, right? You are mm-hmm. very kind of dedicated to your shot and stuff and your equipment. So let's kind of walk through your equipment, you know, whether it's bow, arrow, and then just kind of what your shot process is and what you go through, you know, at the moment of truth kind of thing.
Sure. I'm a very budget oriented guy. I'm minimal. That's why I'm already minimalist in my gear. I'm minimalist now. I spend my money too, but I'm just kind of that guy that I like to use less and do more. And I like for people to be able to see that you can use less and do just as much or more. That you don't have to have the latest and greatest. So that's also the way that I approach a lot of things as well. Not just my setup, but you know, everything. But, I shoot a 60 inch, Timber Ridge recurve, about 47 pounds at my draw length at 29 inches. That's a $300 bow. I think they raised the price on the 350, but, I was kind of in the market for, and it wasn't something I was planning on settling with. It was just something I was wanting to, like, and before I go jumping feet first into a custom bow, I'm like, I need to figure out what I like, you know, like I, like a guy needs to know, like, does he like this much weight? Does he like a recurve? Does he like a long bow? You know, does he like a 60 inch bow or does he like a 64 inch bow? All that. So the bow was kind of a stepping stone towards a custom bow. And my terrible buyer's remorse that I have as a husband, father, a single income house. I took that bow. That's a pretty bow. Like that's a nice looking bow for, gosh dang, for $300. I'll give it a shot. And I'm still shooting it. I haven't made myself put it down, and I haven't tried with great effort to buy anything different. We kind of clicked together a little bit. It hits where I look. So, you know, that's just proof that, you know, you don't have to have as much as I would love to own one, don't get me wrong, you don't have to have a Black Widow PSA or a Stalker or a Schaefer. You know, you can, shoot 10 rings, 12 rings, 100 plus point indoor, you know, rounds, whatever, with a 300 pound bow from Three Rivers. Absolutely. Or a $300 bow from Three Rivers. So,
yeah.
And that's important to me for my viewers to see that as well. Oh, there's a lot of people in my situation. And I would say, with the way times are, a lot of people are in that situation. Not everybody can even throw. I'm really starting to look hard at the Super Kodiaks. I really like the same thing as like the PMA. I'm a huge believer in mass weight in your riser, material in your riser to be forgiving and can help control your shot. So the Kodiaks, the Super Kodiaks, and then like your Damon Howitt. I was listening to you talk to those guys the other day. The Damon Howitt Original Hunter, that style of bow that's got a lot of mass weight, a lot of material in the riser. That's a very forgiving, very accurate style of bow to shoot. But not everybody has $500, even $550, you know, $600 for a Bear Super Kodiak.
Yeah.
And they see guys like Snyder. I mean, granted, I'm a Snyderite a little bit. not gonna lie, you know, like he's that man is doing. I don't care what anybody else says. You can you know, whatever. Hate me, love me, unsub me, whatever. That guy is doing more for the community. Even, you know, switching back to a wheel bow, that man's doing more for the community than many people realize. And for doing it for the right reasons, I genuinely believe that. But, you know, guys see, you know, dudes like him dropping these bombs at, you know, 40 yards and shooting these softball size groups and stuff like that. Like, man, like, all right, I really want to shoot like that, but man, I can't afford a $1,600 bow. You know, shoot, I can't afford a $1,600 bow at the moment. But it can be done. You know, you can use a lesser expensive bow or an old used bow, and treat it and tune it to the best of its abilities and shoot well with it. But yeah, that's my bow. I only shoot 45 pounds. I'm a huge believer that less is more. You know, we've kind of gotten out of the age of guys shooting 60, 70 pound bows. I would like to think, thinking that they're gaining anything from it. And, Cody Greenwood from the Trad Lab can give a lot of guidance to people. I know he really stirs up some dust in the community. I don't know why.
I was going to say, if people listen, then they'll glean something from it. Yeah.
If I was already this far into it as I am and hadn't listened to him and then heard him, I would kick myself in the face if it was possible or ask somebody else to like, will you curb stomp me for not listening to him? Cause he's right. I hate to, you know, burst people's bubble, but the guy's it's proven. It's fact. It's on paper, you know? He said, anything above 65 pounds by the time, I can't tell you how many people I've tried to push impress this on them. They just can't understand anything above 65 pounds. You're not gaining any efficiency because by the time you chase that weight with an arrow that can handle 65 pound bow, you're not gaining any speed. You're not gaining any more momentum. You're not gaining any more efficiency because you're just chasing it. You're chasing bow weight with arrow weight and arrow spine. But I can safely say every deer that I've shot with this particular bow, with the exception of the buck that I shot last season, has been full pass-throughs. No problem. 47 pounds, 45 pounds with a tuned arrow and a sharp broadhead. I can't stress sharp broadheads enough to people. You can blow through a whitetail. You could probably blow through an elk. Shot placement is everything, and being at a range where you're comfortable with that. And as far as rest, I kind of got some guidance from Mr. Tim Nebel on this. I kind of gleaned off of something that I saw he did and kind of adopted for myself, and I really like it. I use a bare weather rest, and I cut the whole top off of the weather rest, because you know those weather rests come with that big old fat meat beefy plate.
Yeah.
I cut the whole top from where a flipper comes into the plate. I cut mm-hmm. that whole top off with a pair of scissors, and then I just put Velcro on the sight window above that and around it for the noise. And it works extremely well. And they're durable.
I cut the top off. The top part off. I'm confused.
For your center shot, you start to really force that center shot out a lot more. And I like to shoot. I also, believe in what Cody Greenwood says, and many other people, not just Cody Greenwood, that a heavy arrow of a heavy overall arrow weight is almost more important than FOC.
Sure.
So you can shoot a 500 spine arrow. I mean, I don't know how some guys do it, you know, but you can shoot a 500 spine arrow with a 300 grain broadhead. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be like, you know, tying a rope around a rock and throwing it. But a heavy overall arrow weight covers a multitude of sins. So by pushing that center shot more to the center requires a stiffer arrow and less deviation in the arrow flight, and more, you know, clean flight off the bow and into your line of sight, in my opinion. And by cutting that, all that extra crap off of there, it lets that arrow set all the way against the sight window rather than being out an extra eighth of an inch.
So yeah, when I used to use the weather rest, right now I make my own. I do like two-sided leather, and I make like a little mini square rectangle of leather that's like trapped between the two leather. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So it's like a little tiny bump, and I do that for the side plate too. Just because nothing wrong with the weather rest. I love those things. I shot them for a long time. But what I also used to do is I used to cut the bottom of that off just to lower that more, because you know it comes as a big plate, right? So by the time you got the launcher arm, I would cut anything off below the launcher arm, so I could scooch it down lower, you know, toward the shelf, and mm-hmm. just barely have the little arm kind of grazing the actual, you know, shelf kind of thing, right? So gotcha. Same kind of thing, just trying to get the knock height, you know, or at least like the height down, you know, so I'm not crawling up the string, which, you know, I mean, if you got like a longer bow, that's not as big a deal. If you're shooting a shorter bow, you know, every little bit kind of tweaks those limbs out of tiller, you know what I mean? Yep. Up or down. So but that's kind of the fun of fun of playing around. So what are you using for a broadhead then?
I'm still experimenting on that. Or shock to anybody that the best penetration that you're going to get is we're going to be with a two blade double bevel broadhead. And that last year definitely proved that. I mean, no deer that I shot felt any, you know, the deer didn't even move until after the arrow had already passed through. I mean, they stuck in the ground behind them, you know, like the penetration was not a factor. I had two holes. To caveat that, the problem with a two blade broadhead is, especially when you shoot behind that front leg or shooting the golden triangle like I try to, as that shoulder drifts back, every time you have to have the stars have to align for that deer to bleed well, because you have this little knife cut, and as those muscles are moving back and forth, that little knife cut, the, all those little knife cuts through all those layers keep misaligning. And so I wasn't impressed with the blood trails. And don't, and people probably think, well, his broadheads weren't sharp. No, they were razor sharp, but that I just was not impressed with the broadhead, with the blood trails from a two blades. So actually this year I'm torn between either three blade cutthroats, any kind of cut on contact head like that, three blade cutthroats, but I'm actually just to keep the penetration factor, I may be leaning more towards a single bevel two blade, because that rotation factor that you get, it's going to make a difference. You know, you might same as a three blade, you know, as at the end of the day, you don't have to have your arrow sticking in the dirt on the other side of the animal. You just need two holes, and to, for the best possible results, you need two holes. You need that animal to be bleeding out two holes in its mouth. So I'm comfortable with sacrificing whatever little bit of penetration that I might lose by switching to a three blade or a single bevel. But, I, at this point, I'm wanting to chase blood trails just a little bit more. I'm also looking at Simmons, broadheads, just for the cut, and the size of the cut. Those things are devastating. I'm constantly tinkering, constantly changing, not ever really sure what I'm going to do, what I'm going to stick with. But right now it's just two blade, double bevel broadheads, 200 grain.
Do you reference the, when you're shooting, do you reference the broadhead? Because I tried the three blade, just kind of shooting them, you know, and like I always clock mine horizontal, right? And not uh-huh. because of any kind of tunability thing, because if it's tuned, it's tuned, like vertical or whatever. But right. I just like the sight picture of it horizontal, right? Uh-huh. And I screwed on a three blade in there, and I kind of drew back a few times, and I was like, whoa, I don't like this, just because I didn't see it, you know, and it just mentally like messed with me, and I'm like, no.
Well, this way that I currently, in my style that I currently shoot with, which I'll go over very quickly. I started instinctive, quickly realized this is not the way, Padawan, to be accurate. There's some guys out there that are born bred absolute killers, instinctive shooting, and can be also be accurate. That is not me. It could also all be a lesson that I'll drive home, you know, whenever we get closer to wrapping this thing up. But I went to gap for realized, okay, mapping your arrow flight, gap is the way, you know, this is how you figure out how to be accurate and know where your arrow is going to hit. And if you shoot gap long enough, you don't even really have a choice, but it was my ultimate goal anyway, is you start to get back to that whole gap stinctive thing. I don't know if you've heard that term.
Sure. Yeah.
Where regardless of how bad you're like, okay, like, you know, I got to put the tip of my arrow here or whatever, like between a certain range until you have to start referencing the tip of your arrow, it just happens. I use my arrow for my left and right, you know, Howard Hill, you know, split style vision style shooting, which, you know, I would say gap stinctive is just a new age way of saying split vision.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people want to talk about it ain't traditional. Well, you know, take that up with Howard Hill, and I'd like to know how that conversation goes. But it kind of inadvertently turned back into split vision. I reference my left and my right of my arrow, but as far as where my tip of my arrow at, I'm still just doing the whole burn a hole thing. And so as far as the broadheads, it really hasn't, regardless of what I've used, it really hasn't screwed me up a whole lot.
Yeah, so I think I've tried it all, right? So I think for everyone kind of comes around to however they shoot differently. But for me, it was, you know, aiming first was definitely a part of the game. But then, like, I'm not like a gapper, right? But after thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of shots, your aim starts to become kind of subconscious aim. You know, and I wouldn't say I'm not instinctive, but I'd most definitely gap instinctive, you know. So I think everybody, especially when it's like 20 and under, right, you kind of get a feel for where the thing's floating and the whole side picture, the snapshot looks good, and you send it, you know. But when I try to actually like gap,
and stuff and aim if it's like longer distances, like beyond 20 yards, I am terrible. Right. So, it just falls apart for me, you know, and it just becomes like a sight pin again and the target panic and but it's something I got to work on, you know, something I got to work on. But yeah, I think everyone kind of arrives at the, you know, if you've ever had anyone ask you, you know, like, hey, how do you aim this thing? How do you start? Should I do this? Should I do that? And like, and you know, I always say, look, this is what's worked for me. Aim first, you know, use it as a sight pin. And then after umpteen thousands of shots, it's going to become a little more natural and you're going to be aiming, but you're not going to know that you're aiming. And I don't care what you call it. You can argue about it on any forum that you want to, but whatever it is what it is. It works for you and just do it, you know? So,
yeah, no, 100%. And I mean, I shoot a clicker. I can't just about not shoot a clicker. I'm not a slave to it. I do stretch it out and shoot without it once in a while just to make myself not be a slave to it. But, I actually kind of had a little short brief. I wouldn't say that we're friends or anything like that, but we've talked a couple times over on Instagram with Snyder, about the whole target panic thing and shooting a clicker. And, some people are born with the stuff. I had such horrible, and that's part of the reason I made the transition, decided it was a good time to do it. I had such horrible target panic with a compound, I didn't love archery anymore. I hated it, matter of fact. I mean, I was the guy that didn't shoot until, you know, a couple weeks before season.
Yeah.
Just because I didn't want to go out and have that, you know, soul-crushing experience of shooting my bow every time. So, and especially knowing the way I used to shoot and not really having any access to a coach or an out or anything like that. So, target panic is just a part of my life. I can still now, after shooting trad long enough, I can still snag up a wheel bow and send some bombers down and still shoot pretty good. But the demon creeps back pretty quick. So I do shoot a clicker, and I think those can be real medicine for people. But that's also, it sounds kind of funny. But I want so bad to shoot an ASL. I really do, because they're freaking cool for one, but Eric makes beautiful ASLs, and I've got to get me one day. I think you have, don't you have one of his bows?
Yeah, that's the one I was just telling you I was caressing while we were talking.
I would be caressing as well, but I can't make myself get a beautiful piece of art like that and slap a clicker on it. I just can't do it. And I've tried, yeah. I've tried the feather to nose thing and I guess I don't, it sounds funny, but I think the makeup of my face, like my nose, like where I anchor to where my nose is and everything, my face doesn't work for a feather to nose, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And so I'm really pretty well left with a clicker. So they so are
I
like fine.
Funny you say that, because I just did a video. I haven't published it yet, but just the other day I just did a video about, hey, how's the feather and nose like working for me, right? Because I did one a while back saying I'm going to try this, my clicker's off, but I'm gonna, you know, and the response from people are going to be like, well, it's just going to be, because I was getting like clicker panic basically, right?
Yeah.
I know you're supposed to work, you know, work on the process and not wait for the click, right? That's the whole point of it. But right. That's the whole part of this. That's the catch 22 with this. So yep. I was getting clicker panic, right? So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna switch to feather to nose. And people are like, well, you're just gonna get feather to nose panic. It's the same thing, anticipation. And I'm like, okay, you're 100% correct. But if I'm gonna get panic from one thing versus another thing, I might as well not have the clicker on the bow. You know what I mean? If they both serve the same purpose, yeah. So I might as well just not have something else on the bow. So so I pulled all my clickers off. And I actually threw them away, so I wouldn't be tempted to put them back on about a year ago. And I've been really, really focusing on the feather to nose. And, you know, on good days, not a problem. On bad days, I am short drawing and plucking, like flinging my finger away from my face before I'm even at like past 24 inches, you know? So it's still a struggle, no matter what you put on, whatever training tool. I don't want to call, well, I've called it a crutch, and it can be a crutch, right? But it's a tool. But no matter what, I don't know. I still struggle with it. But I think the best thing, you know, to do is, you know, I'm still trying to work on like, okay, well, forget even just feather to nose. Like the goal is to go beyond that kind of psycho trigger or whatever and get to, okay, I'm going to be in good alignment, you know? And then I think it was something that Joel Turner even once said relatively not too long ago on The Push. He's like, you know, pretty soon, you know, he's like, just that extra little expansion movement alone is the clicker. It's like a virtual clicker. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I don't know. There's just so much to learn and do in this sport. That's like frustrating, but rewarding, and, you know, one day and then frustrating the next. And I don't know, kind of working on it, but yes, I didn't want to put a clicker on my ASL either. I said, nope, not going
to. Yeah. Nope. Just there. I think Eric might drive to your house and beat the snot out of you if you put a clicker on one of his bows. They're beautiful. But no, that's why I really preach shot process, and and that's not that I just preach it. I live by it. You know, like you, the same with training, whether you play sports, whether it's you're a tier one operator, whatever, you know, you're a product of your training. And if you have no baseline, if you're the guy that just walks out in the backyard, starts whipping arrows out of quivers and trying to burn a hole and hit the spot, you know, you're getting nothing from your practice and you're not growing. That's the beautiful thing about archery and about traditional archery is I don't think anybody is probably ever exactly where they want to be. I know I'm not. So there's a lot of room for improvement, and by having a process from start to finish. Yes, me, my process, you know, from the time that I step up to the, if I'm actually trying to drill my process, for flat range shooting, everything from the time I step to the line to the time that the shot goes off is all, rehearsed. It's all, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And it's the same every time, because if you have no baseline, like, oh, so, that's not traditional, like, I'm just going to pull back and shoot. Well, you know, okay. Well, you know, maybe it's worked for you. Maybe it hasn't. But on high-stress situations, you're a product of your training. So if you're just gripping and ripping and not, you know, having any rhyme or reason to how you practice, you're not going to get anywhere. You have, in high-stress situations, you have to have a baseline to fall back on. And so I drill that baseline religiously in the backyard and from A to Z. Do I do that when I have a deer standing in front of me? Absolutely not. When I have a deer standing in front of me, I'm doing gap stinctive and it happens. I hit what I'm looking at. And that's just the way, and that's just how it goes unless I screw something up. But you can't even do that unless you have something to reference off of. You will take it's like Tom Klum, whenever he was talking about getting his coaching certification. Yep. He's like, how is this supposed to apply to bow hunting? Well, dummy, you take it with you. You know, it's true. You know, like, oh yeah, you may feel like an idiot standing there talking to yourself. I mean, I talk out loud to myself. I probably look like a psychopath, but I'm like, relax, you know, perfection, draw back to my anchor. Pull, 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 you know, when in doubt, keep pulling sort of a thing or whatever. And everything's the same. My bow arm is up when the arrow hits the target, and I go through that same process. And I, you know, kind of like Joel says, decide to make a good shot. The hardest thing in the world to do is let a bow down, you know, and
agreed.
I'm constantly reminded of that. And so whatever, you know, it's whatever you got to do. And that's where I'll kind of bring this all home to a head or whatever. Traditional archery is a very intimate thing. And that's part of the reason I started my channel. That's the mission of my channel. It means different things to different people. Not everybody's a bow hunter. Not everybody is just a 3D shooter. Some people do everything. You know, some people just, you know, something to, you know, a hobby, you know, just, it's the same as, water painting. You know, I'm gonna grow up and shoot a couple arrows or something. It's different things to different people. So don't let everybody else influence you because maybe it's not quote trad, you know. If you have no sights and you are grabbing a string with your fingers, that's trad. Like, you're right back to the Indians at that point. You know, I don't care if you use the tip of your arrow to aim. I don't care if you shoot instinctive or whatever. But that's why I started the channel, because I had to start doing things my way and going against the grain on some stuff in order to figure out my shot and my shot process. And my shooting got exponentially better. I never dreamed I'd be able to shoot softball sized groups at 40 yards on the regular. And that's become reality because I didn't follow every piece of advice that I'd ever heard, because you could go down endless rabbit holes. So, yeah.
The best thing to do too is, sorry to cut you off, but the best thing to do is just be honest with yourself, right?
Yes.
Because the hardest thing, and it sounds weird for people that don't shoot this, right? But the hardest thing is when you completely mess up your shot, right? But you still, like, it goes where it's supposed to go, but it went there, but just by pure luck and happenstance, right?
That's that false sense of security.
Yep, you screwed up 100% of that shot. You plucked it, you short drew it, you whatever, you let it go, you whatever it is, right? And somehow it wound up like dead center, but you know that's a lie.
Yep.
that dead center is a lie, but you have to be honest with yourself. Like, okay, that's just a complete fluke. I didn't, you know, so.
Yeah,
and then on the opposite, like if you take, I don't know, a bunch of shots and then you execute, let's say you got a quiver full of arrows and you execute all five of them, which is rare for me, you know, mm-hmm. With everything perfect, right? Good alignment, good expansion, feather to nose, whatever. And then I had, but I did all that right. But then the arrow went, you know, I had a good group and then like the fifth one went wonky. I still praise myself for that last good shot because I did what I was supposed to do, which was, well, I was practicing making sure I'm coming feather to nose. I screwed up something else. I might have plucked, torqued, whatever. But to me, I did what I was supposed to do. So I praised that shot. You know what I mean? Yep. And it sounds backwards, even though it was like 6-7 inches off to, you know, high and right. I'm like, no, I did what I was supposed to do. So I think that's important.
And it's just like when you're watching Lancaster and someone shoots a 2, barebow. You're never going to be flawless on every single shot. And so, like you said, just be real with yourself, you know where you're at. Don't just cause you see Snyder or whoever dropping 40 yard bombs. That doesn't mean you're Snyder. That doesn't mean that you're you. That doesn't mean that you're me. Your bombs, you know, your tight groups might be 15 yards. Own it, you know, master that 15 yards. And it's probably one of the bigger lessons that I've learned is you predestine how your practices are going to go. If you got to have a short memory with trad, you know, if that first shot is garbage and you let yourself know about it, and the rest of your shooting session is in for a world of hurt, you know, like, oh man, like I suck today. Like, you know, I bet this is how the whole rest of the day is going to go. Just by you saying those words, I almost guarantee you that's the way the rest of your day is going to go.
Because you're already one bad shot instead of the other 49 that you could do perfect, you know?
Yep. You're already defeated, you know?
Yep.
So
yep.
Have a short memory and own your zone and, work through your process. Don't deviate from it. And I think I even said in a video, if you have to drag a whiteboard out to the range with you to write down everything that you're doing wrong on a shot, you know, like, I plucked again. Dadgummit, I plucked again. Well, it looks like you need to work on plucking, you know, or mm-hmm. I'm collapsing. Well, it looks like you need to work on collapsing and not worry about changing your point weight, you know. Whatever you got to do to put pen to paper to know where your weaknesses are and go on the attack at those weaknesses. And maybe one of the best pieces of advice I can give someone that's new or even a seasoned guy. I sometimes get in a groove and don't do it like this, but it's the best way to practice is to leave your hip quiver thrown in the garage, thrown in the basement, back room, whatever, and shoot one arrow at a time.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a worn dirt path to your target, you're probably doing it right, because you're going to make every shot count a lot more if you got that one shot. I've been doing it lately. you know, having my hip quiver on or whatever, and I make a shot that I'm not real super happy with, whipping out another one and launching another one. And then next thing you know, like, man, why am I breaking down so much quicker today? You're like, why am I getting so much tired, so much faster? Like, well, you idiot, you're shooting about 5-10 times more than you normally would. And yep. You're shooting like garbage because you're shooting, you know, you're just following up arrow with arrow. You're not focusing on every individual shot. So it's easy to get in a funk, but yeah, less is more in a lot of areas. And that's one of them.
100% agree. All right, brother, we're almost on like 2 hours here, man.
I know. It's the time flies. we're having fun.
I know. We should probably start wrapping this up. I got to be at work at like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, fun. Yeah. I got to plant a garden tomorrow. So that's not quite as much fun as work.
To me. But yeah, I someone's got to make like laundry and lotions, you know. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, we appreciate you for it because I get to stinking I'll be stinking after that garden operation. So.
Oh, dude, I'm not a fan of summer. I'm like a 3-shower-a-day guy. I, you know, I'm miserable after pretty much turkey season until October. I'm in a funk. So, yeah, I'm not a summer guy. I don't like heat, humidity. No, I like it cold. But
in Minnesota, that's probably for a fact. So,
yeah, it's just humid. So, to wrap up here. So, where can people follow you? Channel, Instagram, all that stuff.
YouTube is the main one. That's the for my health and my, you know, mental health and not being an angry person and having, you know, fits of rage at work and stuff like that. I try to stay off social media as much as possible. The main thing I focus on right now is YouTube, and the channel, if people don't already know, is Backwards Hat. Traditional lifestyle. And the reason I do, you know, you might see on some of my apparel, it says archery. That's just, you know, kind of for the people, you know, whoever wants to do that. But lifestyle encapsulates a lot more, and YouTube punishes you if you get off topic of things and doesn't circulate your videos. So that's why it's traditional lifestyle. But so that's the main place to find me. And you can also find me on Instagram. I've been trying to work on my IG game a little bit. And you can find me over there, Ethan Page, Backwards Hat Nation, or BH Nation, something like that. You can find me over there as well. And I try to post up, you know, here something every once in a while, whether it's personal or trad or lately the Broken Arrow podcast has been doing their cold shot challenges. Those are pretty freaking cool. Those are the two main points. They're really the only places that people can really find me and follow me right now. So
cool. Awesome. Well, listen, man, I really appreciate you doing this on a late Friday night here. You know, I'm glad it worked out. I'm glad we got a chance to talk. So we're definitely going to have to follow up after, you know, season sometime or whatever. And then, you know, redo this again, because I don't know, like I said, 2 hours went by pretty quick.
Yeah, 100%. I'm sorry I kept you on all night when you have to get up early. I can kind of ramble on sometimes.
I'm glutton for punishment for, you know, that's the thing. For stuff like this, I'll stay up all night. If it's for stuff that I don't like, I'm like, I'm tired, I'm in bed.
Yep, same here. But no, this is great. Yeah, we definitely need to reconvene.
All right, so stay with me here while I wrap up. So thanks for being on. Everybody, go follow Ethan on his channel on Instagram, also Boating Soul YouTube channel as well, Instagram, and I'm doing those. So I'll try and do anyway when I have time to do those cold shot challenges and stuff like that too. So lots of fun stuff going on out there. So if you like this content, please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll talk to you guys next time. Thanks.